The second reason it was abandoned is that it required us to take hard and fast decisions about issues that are very fluid in their nature. For example, we have to decide, this is our paradigm, this is our outlook, this is our doctrine, this is our approach, and risk consigning yourself into a particular box in the many boxes that many countries fit themselves in. For example, could have decided going to be a human rights-based foreign policy. A number of countries that have done that have since withdrawn that statement because it is impossible to have to hold a flag. Could have said could have been a foreign policy driven by domestic interests. Many countries have done that, it has become impossible to just hold that line. Some decisions are going to be taken on the basis of ratings, not just of interest. Some investment in foreign policy are going to be made, even though there is no return on the income in material terms. But there is a return on it in terms of significance and prestige and image and issues of that nature. So there was a conscious decision taken by the leadership under President Mandela, and argued very strongly by Minister Ndlovu at the time, that perhaps South Africa should allow some space to act a bit more pragmatically and read and respond to the conditions at that particular time. The third reason that I remember was that the process of discussing the Green Paper itself was so long and inconclusive in conclusion that it was decided that perhaps pushing it too far might cause difficulties among the constituencies that were involved. And therefore, in a way, there was an avoidance of a confrontation among different actors in that particular regard. Now, if you ask me, both were the reasons then. What are the reasons for having a white paper now? I can offer one definite reason, and it's the safest reason for me. It was the fact that the ANC conference of 2007 decided. And that is obvious. In the popularly elected ANC, the government needed to implement decisions, the mandate that it had. But whether the conditions that had led to the postponement of the earlier process had changed or had been covered, had been better understood, it's a completely different question. Whether we are now capable that we can choose a specific frame of foreign policy, a specific nature of diplomacy, a specific position in an environment that is fluid, whether that question has been answered is a different matter altogether. Now, quickly on the paradigm. The first point where the question I ask myself, what is our outlook on world affairs? And what does this white paper say about that? Because any foreign policy must be based on a particular understanding and a view of the world today and the world that we desire. Now, there are, as you know, there are contending views out there. You either look at the contending views that come from within Western thought about how we interpret the world. The some interpret the world as anarchic, which is marked by anarchy, and therefore states use their power, use their foreign policy to accept their interests and survive in a world that is chaotic. Or that the world is generally orderly and that states use the foreign policy to pursue the norms and pursue the principles and even their interests. And that therefore states look for a stable world, whichever way you look at it. Or you look at the views from outside the Western schools of thought that argue that the world is marked by imperiality, that world is marked by a distinction between a small group of countries that are dominating the world and the whole rest of others that are on the periphery, called the periphery. Or they are marked by coloniality, which is a model of power that is premised on hierarchy between a people and other people, nations and other nations, states and other states. Whatever it was, and on that basis say that states fundamentally want another world. That state exists because they want another world that they think is possible. Now, on that basis, what then is South Africa's worldview? It's something that we'll explore as we move further. And on that basis, what is also South Africa's view of the world we want? I'll move to the next slide. Now, the view South Africa has on the world will tell us sort of what ideological position broadly, not in narrow terms, it takes on the world. Is it a reformist state? Is it a state as a global reformer? Which means tinker with the system in order to wage a space for itself to participate in the same system that we call colonial, we call imperial, we call dominated. Key demands, participation, inclusion, and accommodation? Is it desire just to be included and to be accommodated? Does it approach the question of UN reform and global reform on the basis of the fact that we are excluded, or that based on the fact that the whole system is unfair? If it's a reformist, what kind of a reformist is it? Is it a pragmatic reformist, in other words, a reformist that accepts that perhaps a reform is a route to transformation? It's something that you need to do because the circumstance is called for it, you don't have sufficient power to do any more than just call for reform. Or it's a critical reformist. It means you go in there in order to subvert the system, you go in there in order to change it from within. You talk reform, but you're actually acting transformation. Or secondly, is South Africa's ideological position transformationist? Is it basic desire to transform the system? In other words, to turn the system to cause fundamental changes to the system so that you move from a system which is a world for some, or a world without others, to a world for all. Is that what we try in? Is that what our ideological position is? And in that particular case, is South Africa still to deconstruct the system, is trying to restructure the system, is trying to transcend the system, move somewhere else? If it is a performance, is it a pragmatic one, or is it a radical one? If we look at the ALBA countries, in Latin America, for example, Bolivia, Ecuador, Cuba, and the rest of them, their position is close to what we might call radical transformations. They're willing to disrupt the system, they're willing to destroy the system in order to give back to a new system. But the other radical, the other transformations who are more pragmatic, who are not shy in expressing their desire for a different world to the one that we have, but they are willing to do that through a negotiated process, through a staggered process, a gradual process, and all that. Or are we a combination of all? I like to argue that there are elements of South African foreign policy that are reformist, but there are elements that are tilted towards transformation. And therefore, I like to argue that South Africa is much more eclectic. It has a mixed position in a number of things. And I'm going to explain that later on. Now, what is South Africa's posture? And all of that. In answer to this question, we must check whether South Africa is radical and outspoken, like Bolivia, or is radical but soft-spoken, like Ecuador. Or it is critical and outspoken. Or it is critical and soft-spoken. What I mean? Radical and outspoken, I mean it speaks against the system because it wants to destroy it. And it wants to delegitimize the system because the system does not serve everyone. but critical means you find problems with the system, but are not fundamentally opposed to the entire system. There are small little changes, but they are significant because the country must decide where it stands, say, with regards to these things. And this veers to pragmatic to radical the various stances with regards to that. But the better with this, we have to ask this question is because I don't want to misunderstand South Africa's moves, because I have not first asked the fundamental question. What is it trying to do? So that I don't measure its performance on the basis of what I wish it should have wanted to do, but I measure it on the basis of what I know it wants to do. Because many of us either praise it or criticize it on the basis of what our assumption of what it is in our mind are. And that is why we have to consider the outlook, consider the ideological position, and consider how its diplomatic posture is like. And the third element we need to consider is, for me, the choices it makes in terms of how it then carries out its foreign policy. Is it a diplomacy of inclusion in order to subvert the system, in order to contest the space, or is it a diplomacy of rebellion in order to delegitimize the space and therefore create a possibility for a new world, as it was in the 1940s and 1950s, when many former colonies joined the UN system, went in there to confuse it and create so much noise so that it creates a basis for launching a new international order. And all that. Now, with regards to Africa, what is Africa's outlook on Africa? There are two outlooks you find out there, because I'm simplifying, but they generally two that I found out. The one says Africa is a problem, and that Africa's problem is the problem of post-colonialism. So the problems of Africa have to do with the post-leaders that have since emerged after independence, institutions, the governments, the political culture, and therefore the problem of Africa is lack of democracy. And therefore that the solutions in Africa must be about what you do internally to make sure that South Africa catches up with the so-called universal, which is a code name for the West. Or there's an article which says Africa's problems are complex, and also Africa's situation is a complex product of the world in which we live in. In that particular case, the problems are both internal faults and external faults. And therefore the solutions are as much about fixing democracy internally as fixing Africa's relationship with the world at the same time. And I would think that South Africa is tended to see things in terms of the latter characterization. That there are internal challenges in the African continent, the continent must take charge of. If we look at the African license narrative that we put out, I could say South Africa needed a fair share of its opportunities on the world stage in terms of market access, in terms of development, in terms of financing and all of that in the world. But in order to get this, Africa would get its house in order. It would put in place an African peer review mechanism, it would insist on governance, in other words, it would impose certain conditions on itself, correct its internal situations, while demanding that the world do its part on the world. So there was that narrative. What happened to that? The African license as a paradigm helped us argue along those lines. But it does seem as if we have sort of abandoned that idea, or that paradigm. What paradigm are we going to have? I'm going to come back to this one that is suggested here. And I'm going to skip that. And then say, I said that to say, with regards to the strategic choices we're making on Africa, the idea that we did from the front, and if we look at how we handled the campaign for Kosovo and Dlamini Zuma at the EU, we were very bold, we knew what we wanted to do, and we knew what it was for Africa. But once she's elected, we pulled back. So we lead from the front, and then also lead from, and then decide at some point we need to lead from the back. So we have both a France and a Germany at the same time. The France leads from the front, it wants to other, and but Germany always wants to lead from the back because of this baggage and of the Hitler years. So we also carry this baggage of the apartheid years that causes us sometimes to pull back. So we work very hard together with Angola to get closer to there, but we do not see the same kind of energy in support for her tenure at the AU Commission. So we have to decide, or perhaps we have decided that we want to play ball. I just want to leave it to you. Perhaps it's something we must discuss with those who are implementing foreign policy. We're very proud of African identity and we speak it, but sometimes we come across as shy about that, shy to assert that we are as African as everybody else. When it is used against us that we are a white controlled country and all that, we pull back. Nigeria knows how to do that to South Africa very, very well. We have the visa issue. We have the visa issue because South Africans take a decision, these people are not going to be allowed in because they don't have the yellow card. All of us have to get a yellow card. But Nigeria turns us into a question about who South Africa is. The former ambassador was here, now the foreign minister says South Africa is controlled by white people. There's a problem with black people, it doesn't matter that Nigeria is in. We send a team of people to apologize in Abuja. Because our own has been leading us that they doubted whether we are African, and perhaps we didn't act un-African. So sometimes we don't have the courage to take it all the way as a Nigerian. We don't have to be told by you whether we are African. Our Africanness is not conferred on us, but it is something we can't declare. But we aren't able to do that, and Nigeria knows it. Knows that at a time when it wants to get us begging, if we hit one blow, we don't pay blows, we'll go back and we'll apologize. We have anchor states. In order to succeed to establish the NEPAD African license, South African President Bey had to work with four other countries. Five countries underwrote the African agenda. Not the whole 53 of them. Just five countries, of course, skillfully interacting with the rest to make sure they're legitimate. And since 2008, we've been discussing a strategy called anchor state. We are already doing it, but when we now have to discuss it, we don't want to declare it. We want to decide it. We've already been doing it since 1999, but when we have to discuss it, it became a little bit of a problem. Seems to me, and this white paper also dices around that, do we want to take every 53 African country along on every major issue you want to go? And how do you do that? Or do you go with four or five countries that represent different arrangements on the African continent and know that they will have to consult with the rest of them? They themselves represent sufficient constituents on the African continent to push an important agenda forward. We have to make that decision because our African agenda will not work if we are hoping that everybody else likes it, so it will just happen. To get African nations idea adopted, to get the AU, the transition from OVG to AU, to get the NEPAD done, APRN done, we have to work with a few countries and push for the plan, and we're not apologetic about who we were. There were attempts to blackmail South Africa, the President Bey, I remember, but they decided to laugh it off and say, no, we're doing this in the interest of Africa and pursue it. Similarly, when we worked on the transformation of SADC, the transformation idea of SADC, we worked with Zimbabwe, we worked with Namibia, we worked with Mozambique, and we worked with Tanzania, and that was enough. We were able to do. So, what does this white paper say about that? This slide is going back to the point I just made, that perhaps we have a Gramscian dilemma. It is Gramsci who said the old is dying and the new is struggling to be born. So it is perhaps, and I'm saying this because the old is what happened in 1994. I know people are saying, 1994 was new. old is what happened in 1994. 1994 was a compromise which brought together the old order and the new order to coexist. There was no complete replacement of the old with the new, if anybody remembers. Which therefore meant that applies to everything, including our ideological position. And as long as you are South African, even if you were actually racist, you are still part of us. And those elements, including in common everywhere else, we coexist. So the progressive coexists with the conservative, and it's their nature. That is why South Africa can be conservative and still progressive at the same time. Depending on which phase you fall. The space that the people in Malawi experience with our supermarket is a conservative one. Even though the phase they experience and encounter with our embassy is a progressive one. But both in South Africa. So perhaps that is it. Now lastly on what we've decided, what this white paper is deciding in our paradigm. It's called the diplomacy of Ubuntu. There are two issues to say about that. One is, it is great that South Africa is deciding to name its paradigm of diplomacy, of foreign policy. But I wonder, does this replace the African license? It is not clear whether it is building upon, which is could be strategic to do, or it is replacing it. Because we have gone through an habit where what was done between 1999 and 2007 has to be abandoned. Quiet. In the bad years, whatever done by the government, not by me, by the government, by the ANC government, in those years, we have got to look away from it. And then, if we work so hard, spend so much money to root the idea of African life as it became a political position for every African country, do we really have to abandon that and then create a new basis for another consensus? So we'll always be trying to build a consensus. When will we implement? I hear that even the fund that the deal is going to come here might not be called African license again. That is. The second issue is, what do we mean by Ubuntu? It's a beautiful concept and it's a beautiful potential to affirm our indigenous way of doing things and asserting our Africanness. But do we mean that in this report? What I don't suggest that is what the full meaning of it, but if you read here, we use Ubuntu to mean kindness and relations and friendliness and cooperation, but Ubuntu does not mean that alone. Ubuntu can also mean confrontation, can also mean destruction of that which is not Ubuntu, that which is not, which does not create a basis for human beings to agree. So it's not just friendship, but it's also confrontation. There is this narrative, it is built around the narrative of Alan Mandela, oh, nice guy and stuff like that. So then you paper over the radical elements of it. And Ubuntu can also be used to say, we will be nice to everybody. Because nothing used, again, to define the transition from foreign affairs to relations. That in the past we used to be more affairs oriented, so we take a different position, we challenge the US, we stand on the side of the excluded in the world, but now we want to relate. We relate to everybody. Ubuntu doesn't mean that. I hope we'll not mean that. The third point that I want to make is to quote from what Wellington has said. It says, the tiger does not announce secrecy, but it pounces. Is it important for us to announce we'll use the diplomacy of Ubuntu, or should we just use the diplomacy of Ubuntu? Thank you. Then the last point, the very last point is, there are issues there that you might want to pick up. One is an important point about saying, and I think that should be a central point of our foreign policy, or about Africa policy generally, is that we support institutions. Because to support institutions your agenda will stay long after you are gone. If it is too silent on agenda, then it is. If it is not, then it dies. The Africa Partnership Program, it was driven by President Bailey, Obasanjo, Bouteflika, President Wade later on, and Emirates Zenawi. They have since lost their position, many of them, so the Africa Partnership Program is gone. It was our engagement with the G8 to demand that they pay their dues to help African countries. Those in the institutions like NEPAD, they did for the same. So internationalization is very important. The second point is to make a very strong determination here about common positions and promote African common positions and all that. But we need to think about what we do in situations where a common position leads to a zero-sum game. This is not progress. It talks about the structural changes in the political economy, but it doesn't say South Africa, what do we mean by structural? What structural changes do we want to see on the continent? Perhaps we want to see a move away from natural resource dependence. Perhaps we should have changed. It's not a thing. It says continued support for NEPAD and PAM. I find that a bit timid. We invested a lot on NEPAD. We invested a lot on occasional PAM. We should do more than just more support. We should make this work, make sure that it is able to do work for the continent. We are very bold on SACU because it says SACU must evolve into an anchor for SADC. Very bold. It is very good. Very bold on synergy between bilateral and multilateral in Africa. Then we say SADC will be an instrument for effective development cooperation. And the last one is South Africa trade policy and strategy framework outlines our economic diplomacy. That's why we say it is. If you want to know our economic diplomacy, go to the South African trade, read the South African trade policy and strategy framework. Great, but I think we need the same for the other areas as well. We need the same for the African agenda. There must be a policy framework that says how we turn the vision into practice, even if it's not public, even if it's not out there in public. South African multilateralism, South African global government, perhaps we need specific guidelines, guiding policies or framework in those areas as well. Thank you very much. I'm very sorry. The last point I wanted to make is that the challenge we need to think about, and you honorable members will help us with this, because we talk about it in the observation environment. There is no domestic consensus about South Africa in South Africa. There is no domestic consensus about the national question because there is a compromise. But the compromise was only a milestone, not an end. Will we get to a point where we now confront the real issue? And so that we can then have a consensus because foreign policy is an extension of domestic policy.
Thanks. Thanks, Doc. Over to the next presenter.
Thank you, Chair. And I think it's going to be a hard act to follow up to Dr. Zondi. But anyway, basically, I think Dr. Zondi has contextualized many of, I think, are the strategic issues around South Africa's foreign policy, particularly since the white paper has been adopted from 2012 till now. And the first point I want to make about this is that South Africa, I mean, foreign policy in general is a moving target. So yes, you're right. You cannot necessarily structure a paradigm or structure a framework which consistently has a relevance because it's always changing and there's always new impetus in foreign policy. But what was really interesting about the paper, that the topic that I've been given, is to actually look at South Africa's relationship and I think more importantly the issues that inform South Africa's relations and engagements with the global south. Around the last point that Dr. Zondi talked about, and that was global governance. What is it that actually is the traction that brings these two spaces together? And I think interestingly enough, the paper is quite clear. You know, it starts off with a very interesting point. It says there are two.
Point of order. We don't see the
presentation. No, I don't have a presentation.
Oh, okay. And she's just saying thank you. You are just starting.
Do you want me to put it down? Would it be better?
It should be better.
Okay.
You have it. No. She she's not saying put that down. She thought you would have a presentation.
No, I don't know.
Now she's there like that. Oh, sorry, but if you don't have it, yeah, then she's now clarifying. He is now clarifying.
Okay.
Proceed.
Thank you. So I'll share this. There were two things that struck me in the paper. It says that South Africa has two tenets of its foreign policy. One is pan-Africanism and the other is South-South solidarity. And I found that to be very interesting because based on the period in which this paper has been prepared and adopted by cabinet, South-South solidarity has become quite a key feature of South Africa's foreign policy engagement since, I would say, since 2005, particularly I think over the period in which we see the level at which South African engagement with South actors on the global south has emerged. It seems to be that South Africa places an incredible amount of emphasis in terms of crafting and strengthening its engagement with global actors from the south. But having said that, it also tends to recognize that whilst there's the global south or the rise of the global south, it also seems to recognize that the global south is not a homogenous group of actors, that there are different actors at different levels. So in other words, some actors are more powerful than others. Some actors actually may want to actually be part of the existing global architecture through their economic rise, and they give examples of countries like China and India and so forth. And I think more importantly, it's about how do these actors want to actually transform the global arena, particularly in the context of transforming the power relations and the rule-based system of the international structure. It is interesting that part of that discussion comes back to the point that Dr. Zondi was raising, and that is where does South Africa's identity as an actor, not only in Africa, but more globally, as part of being an actor in the global South, where does it fit in this whole construct of being developing its relations with the global South? And it basically comes back to the question of reform or transform. Because what it says, very interestingly, is that it says that we need to reform the architecture of the global system, because this is an outdated architecture. It's set in the post-Second World War period. It doesn't necessarily reflect the changes of other actors that have arrived and that have arisen from the global south. It actually excludes the voice and marginalizes the voice of Africa and the south, and therefore we need to reform it. But in saying that, it doesn't say how it wants to reform it. And that I thought was quite interesting in the paper, where it talks about inclusion, that South Africa will continuously talk about inclusion. The second point is that South Africa does not see the global south as being basically homogenous, as it spoke about earlier. And that for me was critical, because they recognize that certain actors in the global south can actually undermine south-south solidarity, because their idea would be to become part of the global north. And that in itself was an interesting space. So what does this all mean for South Africa? South Africa identifies its role in respect of the issues that it takes forward on South-South cooperation and global governance, is that it wants to champion the concerns of the South within international institutions and fora, but at the same time, it wants to also ensure that the South doesn't become a bloc that's too powerful in itself. So in a sense, it says we still need to promote the role of LDCs, least developed countries, low developed countries, whose voice in international institutions are marginalized. Because in that way, we can actually promote, for example, the role of the ACP, the African Caribbean Pacific countries, the role of countries in the WTO, in terms of bringing about greater parity and greater structures in terms of trade, in terms of trade access and leveling the playing field. But at the same time, it also recognizes that the global south has now produced new ideas or new issues for concern in global governance institutions, human security, trade issues, environmental sustainability, poverty alleviation, terrorism, human rights, etc. And in that way, I think the idea of what South Africa sees as its role in the global south is essentially about how do we create like-minded partnerships. So if we are going to start pushing for an agenda at the UN level in terms of reforming the UN Security Council, in terms of reforming the global architecture of financial institutions that have been excluded and exclusionary, how do we actually create partnerships? And this is what the underlying basis of their foreign policy with actors from the global south are. It's about collaboration, it's about partnership, it's about developing a collective vision around the reform agenda. At the same time, I think what's interesting is that the role that South Africa sees in terms of placing emphasis with partnership from the Global South is about moving the power blocks in international relations away from having particular countries enjoying their own space, their own power. And in this way, there's a question of legitimate representation that comes in. Again, the question in the back of my mind is, what are these countries talking about? Is it collective vision, or is it again based on what is my interest in these institutions? And so there is a disparity, or there is a disconnect in the paper around, are my interests in terms of reforming the institutions the same as the interests of the actors from the Global South? That doesn't come out very clear, because again, these are aspiring actors from the Global South. They all want to actually be part of the international system in terms of the power base, etc. The opening line of how South Africa defines multilateralism, and that's a key driver of how it embraces its engagements with the Global South, is multilateralism. Through multilateralism, we will reform the system. That seems to be a driver. And in that context, it says we want to move the power bases that have become evident in international institutions like the UN, the Security Council, like the World Bank and the IMF in terms of voting shares and rights, etc., to a more inclusive rules-based system. But there's nothing about how you're going to create that rules-based system that reflects the current evolving structure of the international system. If the international system today is in a state of fluidity, how do you create those rules? How do you ensure that those rules are upheld? And that, to me, is a bit of a weakness in that point. The third element I want to say is that more at the domestic level, it's quite clear that it seems to me that the African foreign policy has significantly shifted towards the Global South. It's interesting that in the period between 1999 and 2008, there was interesting, significant ideas around what Dr. Zondo was talking about, is placing the African agenda on the agenda of the G8, particularly with global institutions of the Global North, that you have a responsibility to start providing a better access of governance for Africa, that you need to provide not just aid, but you need to provide development aid, development assistance, that you need to address Africa's development agenda. It seems to me now that South Africa has now shifted that the African agenda has to be placed on the agenda of key actors from the Global South, and hence we see BRICS that emerges there. We see what South Africa says in terms of the role that BRICS can play in restructuring the global architecture, global economic reform and global political reform, the governance at the end of it, the role that South Africa plays in the basic climate change grouping of Brazil, South Africa, China and India. In that, it's about providing how the Global South is going to address the question of environmental sustainability. And similarly, in the G77 in China, it sees that these are institutions that have not been able, and the General Assembly, these are institutions that have not been able to actually have their decisions that make binding impact on institutions like the UN. So it sees its role in terms of forming these coalitions within the Global South to improve, to push, to leverage what it thinks is a collective vision with like-minded actors from the Global South. But having said that, it's also very clear that actors from the Global South have their own so-called vested interests and national interests. And how the South Africa's interest in those contexts fit in is not very, very, very clear in the paper itself. So the paper is very broad on that context. So the fourth point to make is that where does the policy of Ubuntu fit in the context of the Global South? Because these are aspiring actors. These actors have basically started to look at Africa in the context of the African rising narrative. How does South Africa fit that narrative in this diplomacy? How does it look at these actors? Are these actors different? Are these actors status quo actors? You know, are they just willing to be part of the system? Do they want to transform the system, radically transform it, and how so? And whether South Africa's position and paradigm fit in that context becomes very interesting, because there's a sense that there are levels in which there will be certain coalitions in the Global South that will be productive and certain coalitions that may not be productive. I think what is really clear now on the global governance agenda is the role that BRICS has begun to assume after the Portuguese summit in July 2014. We see a parallel set of institutions emerging, and those parallel sets of institutions have not necessarily set out what is the global governance agenda, particularly in terms of lending from the bridge to the, from the new development bank. How will that lending actually impact on global governance architecture, particularly financial architecture? Will we see new debt crises emerge? Will we see new challenges in the financials architecture? And also in the context of the of what is happening in Asia right now, in terms of Asia becoming quite an important geopolitical space for powers like the US and the EU trying to offset what China is creating with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is the which was the opposite to what the US wants to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. So there's a lot of interesting geopolitical dynamics in the Asia-Pacific region, which may have certain implications for what the role of certain actors in the global South Sea in global governance. Where does South Africa put those spaces, I think, needs to be clearly defined. Perhaps there is a need for South Africa to consider having to deal with the global South, not necessarily putting it all together as part of a multilateral, but to disaggregate it. What is your relationship to Africa, to the global South in terms of governance? So there needs to be a global governance discussion document. There needs to be something much more clear about the changing dynamics of the global South. And then I want to make two last points, and this really relates to how South Africa includes other actors out from the global South that do not form part of what it considers to be its BRICS partners. How does it look beyond the BRICS? Because to a large extent, I think the BRICS seems to inform a lot of how the definition of global South is coming about. But there are other actors. There's Turkey in the G20. For example, Turkey is going to become the chair of the G20 after the Australians assume it this year. And that's a critical area in where South Africa's role on peace and stability can be actually forged with a country like Turkey. Then there's also a country like, there are also other countries in the Asia-Pacific region like Vietnam, Cambodia, etc. But there are other countries there who actually play a critical role in their regions as well. So how does South Africa look beyond the BRICS in forming alliances and partnerships in international structures where they can actually advance a collective vision on global governance? And then finally, there's a very interesting point on definition of economic diplomacy in the paper. It's a very important idea, but economic diplomacy, I think, can actually be quite an important tool in advancing a global governance agenda. It's not only about access to markets and trying to improve access to markets and improve access to markets for South African goods. But economic diplomacy can also be an important area in which you pull together a group of countries around defining what the international regime on trade is. And this is where I think South Africa's role in the WTO, in the Doha development round, will be critical, particularly in the context of what it sees as linking the African agenda to its global South agenda. Thank you.
At this point, I hand over to Professor Laster.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I was particularly encouraged by the tone of your introduction, Chair, to say that we are not members of the committee or parliament or of DERCO, so we have some sort of carte blanche. My wife warns you that I teach a diplomacy, but I don't always know how to practice the art of diplomacy. So I can be a bit frank, and I'm afraid to say I'm going to continue with that tradition. Let me start vulnerable. I was struck by the very interesting comment you made when I introduced the NRF Sarchi Chair. And you ask, so what is this animal? Many people actually ask if I have got some marketing to do. Let me just give you some context. The National Research Foundation, South Africa's most important research, training, and innovation body in the country to build the the competitiveness of South Africa in the areas of R&D, research and development, which is fast becoming an indicator to measure the success and standing of countries in the world, took the bold initiative to set up national research chairs in specific areas, a very competitive process, in order for us to build and enhance skills in that area. Let me just give you a scary statistic. South Africa is a member of BRICS, this illustrious body. We spent as much as China, as Brazil, Russia, and India on GDP per capita towards R&D. So per capita, we empower Germany with the United States and all our rich partners. That's the good news. Bad news is this republic, between 26 universities, produces 2,000 PhDs per year. One university in India produces 5,000 PhDs per year. One university in India. I'm suggesting to you, the question that I want to raise today is whether this republic can sustain a highly ambitious, often incorrect, all over the place foreign policy that seeks to please everybody, and we're not clear what our priorities are. I'm going to end with some good news, by the way, about the white paper on foreign policy, but I'm going to be frank this morning. Let me start by what I think triggered this white paper on foreign policy. I want to be frank and candid, because 6 years later, we all have a less worried about slates and camps and so on, so we can say certain things. I wish to put in the record that I think this document came about because the new administration felt the desperate need to show that it was different to its predecessor administration, the American administration. And I'm suggesting to you that this white paper was rushed through, and the question that I want to ask is, what is contained in this document, both in terms of content, the way it's written, and priorities, whether it merits a white paper? So, I have a presentation here, and this is what you call 2 points about this presentation. We were widely consulted in 2011 when we started the process, Dr. Zondi. Widely consulted. We had fascinating meetings at Durko. And I must say, we were widely consulted. We were not excluded. Some of us cautioned against the idea as Dr. Zondi started. And we asked the question whether, in fact, it is possible for a moving, fluid target, an issue like foreign policy and world affairs, to be contained in a white paper. Because once something is codified in a white paper, it becomes legislated, it becomes a piece of law, you can't deviate from it, then you have to stick religiously to it. Now, I wish to suggest to you that this white paper, in the form that it is presented to us today, is a reflection of the interpretation of world politics at the time it was written. So in other words, whatever was the prevailing predominant issues in world affairs 2010, 11, 12, that is now contained in our white papers. Question, 3 years from now, will this still be the prevailing issue? Let me give you one example. There is an obsession in this country with BRICS. Right? There's an obsession with BRICS. It's a very illustrious and powerful club. We're not the biggest player within BRICS. We have to earn our keep in BRICS. And this is something positive about it that I think we should do in BRICS. Because South Africa is going to come under pressure to justify the global attention that it is enjoying. Dr. Zondi reminded us that South Africa, I know many of you in the room and certainly in Durko hate the idea of us saying South Africa is punching above our weight. In other words, we play in a boxing league that is too heavy for us. We're in the Premier League, but we could be relegated if we're not careful. So we have to train all the time to maintain our position. So within BRICS, flavor of the month. as we celebrate BRICS and trying to figure out South Africa's role, I can think of at least three emerging southern formations that could potentially rival BRICS, but at least compete with BRICS. There is now the emerging MICTA group, Mexico, Indonesia, the sea, I must say, but it's Thailand, South Korea, and Australia. There's MICTA. Then there's MICT. Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, Turkey. And Turkey is often MICTA. So, you have southern powers who feel that they are being excluded, but they're asking the more fundamental question. Are those who are represented in BRICS, particularly the African one, is that the only one that belongs there? Is South Africa really the only one that should be on the G20? Should we be the only one on BRICS? Should we be the only one on the G20? Why did we fight so hard to get this AU Commission position? Why did we? What ultimately drove us? So, two points from my 2011 presentation, and then I move on to what the chair asked us to do, a brief assessment of the four presidencies, and then I'll conclude, ironically, colleagues, with something positive about the white paper. So I want to say something positive, but I don't want to throw the big rhythm out there. So let me give us the two points I made about the white paper. I said it's dangerous to contain a foreign policy in a white paper. At best, I suggested, if we are going to contain our foreign policy in a white paper, probably bold enough to codify a foreign policy in a white paper, confine the content of such a document to a set of uncompromising, non-negotiable principles and values that the country stands for, particularly derived from our constitution, that all of us in this room, irrespective of political orientation, civil society orientation, could agree with. So in other words, they are never changing things. They're going to remain in Africa for the next few decades, maybe even centuries. I also said, let's codify those values that are important to us. Not only is democracy, human rights, but let's not forget where we come from. Liberation, self-determination, ownership, African identity, and Africanism. I said, that's what we should do at best. Otherwise, we're going to be overtaken with events, by events, as Dr. Zondes and I said. That's not what you should do if you are going to go the white paper. But I caution against it. Enough about that. Let me now move on to just a synopsis of the four presidencies. Right. It has now become commonplace to suggest that the President Mandela's foreign policy era will be remembered as the quote-unquote pro-human rights foreign policy era. I think it was seen as a mischaracterization of our foreign policy, because that famous 1993 article by the former president, written before he became the president of the republic, but was still president of the ANC at the time, in Foreign Affairs of 1993. Human rights definitely sticks out in that document. There's a famous phrase called the canonization of human rights in our foreign policy. But that foreign policy document singled out five other key principles that observers community forget. It came out in favor of greater regionalization in world affairs and service. So Africa should commit to regional integration, particularly in Africa. I want to ask this question. 20 years later, is South Africa as committed to driving the regional integration agenda in Africa as it claims? There is a claim that we're not only driving the African agenda, that Africa is not only first in our foreign policy, but that we are placing it central in our foreign policy. I'm begging the question 20 years later, is Africa really enjoying the pride and place in our foreign policy that we claim it is? Third element, we live in an interdependent world, and states should learn to cooperate. So there was a strong identity about South Africa being a pro-cooperation internationalist and solidarity countries. Countries striving for solidarity. There was another principle. Then there was the principle about a fundamental commitment to the rule of law. And let me come to the most important one, which is in line with the white paper. And I'll say something about Ubuntu later. The DNA of this country's politics, the DNA of our national politics, of our foreign policy, is the manner. Whatever your views were in 1993, 94, 89 to 94, whatever your views were on whether you pro a negotiated settlement or not, we came about through a negotiated settlement. That's how we resolved this dastardly apartheid system. Never going to say a word, by the way. We call it, for the record. The DNA for leftist politics is negotiated solutions to politics. That's how we came about. That's our identity. And I think we're not making and building enough capital of this in world affairs. If there's one identity that sets South Africa apart from many, if not all, countries in the world, is that we are willing to save. We are willing to talk to Boko Haram for the sake of peace. We don't believe in bombing people out of existence. That's not our policy. If we could talk to people who were declared by the United Nations perpetrators of a crime against humanity, then we should bring belligerents around tables and talk. A question, do we make enough capital of that identity in our foreign policy? Incidentally, that is the thing about Ubuntu that I'm going to return to. So there was the Mandela foreign policy. Let me say just one word of criticism against it. There was a fundamental gap between ambitious and stated foreign policy by President Mandela's administration and implementation. Now, here comes the interesting part for those of you who attended Polokwane and Mangalhung and all these other interesting conferences. There is no doubt that the further we move away from 2008, the contribution of a certain double backing to foreign policy, this is not making a personal statement, people, this is looking at hardcore analysis, that it became a thought through foreign policy. Africa was placed first, the African agenda was clarified, South-South cooperation was put on the agenda, North-South dialogue was put firmly on the issue, on the radar screen, the issue of global governance, both political and socio-economic, was put centrally on the agenda, and then the question of bilateral and economic, bilateral political and economic relations. But there's a clarity that emerged about South Africa's foreign policy agenda that I think we're going to marvel at the further we move away from that period. President Botswana has 7 months. Let me say something about the 7 months. I think the greatest contribution of President Botswana is 7 months is that, fortunately for him, it coincided with the height of the global financial crisis. And he led South Africa's delegation to the G20 meeting. And then came out that we occupied the only African position in the G20. Question again, do we as South Africa, playing that role as the only African country in the G20, do we play that role with the necessary activism, seriousness to craft an African agenda on the G20? Or do we, sorry to put it so crudely, say, do we just occupy space sometimes? Let me introduce this question before I do a two-sentence assessment of the Zuma government's foreign policy. Is South Africa finding itself in the invidious position where we confuse positional leadership in world affairs? Leadership is derived from the position we occupy. Member on the UN Security Council for 2 years, member of IPSA, member of BRICS, chair of the African Union Commission, and so the list goes on and on and on and on. Do we confuse positional leadership with strategic leadership? Do we have a strategic presence in world affairs or are we fast losing that strategic calm and respect we command? Brings me to the Zuma government's foreign policy. On paper, no matter what happened at these important ANC conferences, there has not been a fundamental shift away from the foreign policy of President Mbeki, just as there was continuity between the foreign policy of President Mbeki and Mandela. On paper, there is continuity. In practice, I have to say two things. There is a fundamental gap between a stated foreign policy on paper, an increasingly flooded with documents that spells out the paper on foreign policy, including this document that we're discussing today, and the foreign policy, whether it's coherently written, so I mean, you know, you can send it to a super editor, you can bring a bit of coherence, but there's a stated foreign policy. Whether we are good at implementing foreign policy, another question. I want to urge this committee, in its oversight function, without being confrontational, something that I'm suggesting here, is to place the emphasis more on the implementation of foreign policy. Not the stated principles and goals, because there are many of them. Right? But implementation. It's the first point about the Zuma government's foreign policy that I want to highlight. Concern. The gap between stated policy and operationalization. Second concern I have. I am depicting an increasingly utilitarian, economic-driven, economic-obsessed foreign policy. Now, let me clarify. We have to become better at economic diplomacy, which this document is. We have to become better at commercial diplomacy. We have to become better at cultural and sports diplomacy. All of these diplomacies. Question is there a risk that this emphasis on economic diplomacy under the guise of the national interest could easily come conflated as a regime interest driven foreign policy as opposed to a national interest driven policy? In other words, whether the regime's interest, the government's interest, and the companies and conglomerates and big actors around government benefit from foreign policy as opposed to the nation. Finally, the two positive things about this document. The two positive things about this document. I think South Africa, a Vietnamese delegation visited South Africa not so long ago, and they described South Africa as the policy capital of the world. Man, we turn our policies right. It's unbelievable. Man, we produce documents. We have so many discussions, foreign policy discussion documents. And let me try to be kind to this one. This one is not a white paper. It's another discussion document. But there are at least 7 foreign policy discussion documents developed between 1996 and this one. We have too many foreign policy documents. We go back and we rewrite and we cut and paste and we say the same thing, but we don't get serious about it. But let me now conclude with two things. There are two things that stand out for me in this document, apart from all the other elements, South-South, North-South, Africa First, global governance, it's all in there. But there are two things that stand out in this document. It could have done a better job of elaborating this concept. It says explicitly, and this is the contribution of the Zuma government's foreign policy. It is more explicit than any other government so far to say we should have a national interest-driven foreign policy. But what I like about the conceptualization of national interest in this particular document is that it touches on, for me, the greatest weakness in South Africa's foreign policy for the last 20 years, whether it's under Presidents Mandela, Mbeki, or even Zuma, President Zuma, or the 7 months of President Trump. And that is, there is a fundamental disjunction between the domestic imperatives of this country, the domestic need, which is clearly spelled out in this document, consolidating democracy, the triple challenges of poverty, inequality, joblessness, building the economy. All these domestic imperatives are spelled out in here. There's an assumption running to this document and many other documents, that our foreign policy is driven by domestic interests. But I suggest to you, never the twain shall be. One amendment I want to recommend to you modestly is become better at saying to Jericho, what are you doing abroad in the name of the Republic to help it to address these fundamental domestic priorities? Because after all, foreign policy is driven by domestic policy. Final point and very important. Ubuntu is poorly defined in this document. They could have defined Ubuntu much better. It's a bad news. The good news about the idea of Ubuntu, I was indifferent about the idea of Ubuntu. But let me tell you what Ubuntu says. And it's actually a document by Minister Mahiti Tonkwana Mashabane. She gave a speech about 2 years ago in which she elaborated. She didn't use the concept of Ubuntu at the time, but she gave us, in line with Dr. Gandhi's idea of contending ideas of foreign policy. So I conclude on this note where I started, the DNA of South Africa's foreign policy. And what Ubuntu seems to me should suggest in foreign policy terms is that this country does not subscribe to a confrontational, militaristic, big brother, realist type of foreign policy, but believes in negotiations, believe in fighting for the poor, believe in bringing north and south protagonists in conflicts, rich and poor together, to come up with common solutions to foreign policy. It seems to me that's the identity of South Africa that people know us for since 1994, and I think we should infuse this in our foreign policy under the banner of Ubuntu. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm advised that Michelle, yes, you're going to make a summary, and your surname is present. You're present. Present with a T. Yeah, and after that we'll have a very short break of about 10 minutes. Then we'll come and ask some certain questions, some certain engagements, but we've got enough time. Parliament will sit and pray today, and we'll also have our lunch. Over to you.
Thank you. If I'm not so much going to make a summary, I'm more going to be before discussing. I didn't prepare a slide presentation because I first had to listen to what colleagues had to say and essentially respond to that. So I'm going to speak about, concentrate on two things. This whole notion of the economic diplomacy part in this favor, and specifically on the obsession of foreign direct investment. And I'm going to also talk a little bit about international governance reform and about civil society participation. So firstly, this foreign policy, and like many governments in the world and also in Africa, is obsessed with attracting foreign direct investment and this belief that when we attract foreign direct investment, there will be a trickle-down effect and there will be growth and there will be jobs that will deal with issues of poverty. The 13, 20 years in this country, the results are very obvious. We don't have jobs. People feel that they're in a worse condition. Many of the trade unions say we have jobless growth. So, and this now is the situation of the country. But what I find contradictory about this document is that in the beginning it has a whole context about cooperation, about the impact of globalization, both positive and negative. It says we go beyond competition, but in the second part, in every second, I'm not sure, I should have counted how many, that we must improve our competitive advantage. Competitiveness. So it falls into the trap of a kind of still, and I'm going to use the ideological word, of a neoliberal economic paradigm. So, and it's still very much changing in this country. I mean, Gondi was saying, are we in South Africa reformers or transformers or switch in between?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
But South Africa seems very nervous to take the leap or to think out of the box. I'll keep it in the reformers, and it's sometimes thinker on transformers, but very, not very often. So I'd say, South Africa is quite radical on Palestine, so, and they will have a very forthright voice and a strong voice and support Palestine against the major money countries. Even quite recently, and I was saying to you that I'm working in that Safe People business campaign, the security dissident for corporate power. Recently, at the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva, South Africa took a very strong position and supported Ecuador. When Ecuador proposed a binding treaty obligations for transnational corporations, as opposed to what's currently on the table, which is these guiding principles. South Africa with Ecuador won the majority vote. The US and the EU do not want to see the binding treaty for transnational corporations and innovation. So there it's quite a radical stance. And I want to, I brought this infograph, that in this document it has a clear sense of the sort of state of the world. And when Chris and John Lewis also said, all these issues will be relevant. But, the global crisis, the climate crisis, etc., they probably will be so relevant in the next 20 years. And the challenge is, how is South Africa part of addressing it, in its different collaborations. And one thing that's very clear is that corporations have become more powerful in states. Their revenues are bigger than states. And just in this table, Walmart is now with United States and China, still the largest economy. But Walmart and a Royal Dutch Shell, Exxon, a Chinese company, has bigger revenues than South Africa. We are number 33 on this list. So clearly, we're in a state of the world where things are very wrong and very skewed. So there needs to be a new way of thinking. And so I don't find that this foreign policy is tuned into a different paradigm or shift to say. And another issue around finances, that South Africa is number 2 behind Nigeria for illicit capital flight. And so for a country of us that is very sophisticated, we have South African revenue services that can collect tax on the little people, that doesn't seem to be collect tax on the corporations. But the point is that the nature of our economic policy will not allow for the types of policy we purporting. We want industrialization. We want to see a more integrated regional response. But yet, the economic policy around investments and trades, around capital outflow, our investment agreements, corporate investors a whole lot of rights. And when they talk about nationalization, even if our government wanted to, South Africa will be bankrupt because these corporations will take us to the investor court. So, all these investor rights are protected in these investment agreements. So I feel that the document's a little bit naive to say that we want all this kind of industrialization, and unless it's going to tackle the nature of the current economic policy. So to move along, I want to speak about international governance reform. And so South Africa, and with its partners in the BRICS, is very strong on international governance reform. And Chris put it quite nicely, are we just taking the space,
or, you know, do we actually want to challenge the nature of these institutions? So institutions are important, but again, if the policy imperative isn't going to shift towards a more kind of social justice or more people-orientated policy, then we're in trouble. So for instance, for the International Financial Institute, South Africa is calling for more space to, you know, sit on the World Bank and in the governance, but yet it doesn't challenge the commitment to austerity. So, which means when countries are in trouble, the first cut they make is the social cut. And you also see the consequences. Many countries, citizens in Europe, are uprising immediately when government says austerity cuts. So, my big suggestion or recommendation here is that the policy has to start tapping the nature of these institutions and their policy. So both investment policy, and I can see that I won't have time to, but I can share ideas on what a developmental investment agreement would be, and then so that you know, money's just not leaving the country in a sense. So these are the sorts of ideas that what it means to have institutional reform, because even NEPAD's questionable. If NEPAD's policies, and I'm working on analyzing the program for infrastructure development in Africa, and just yesterday I was sitting in the joint committee on the Grand India project, and I was a bit astonished at the lack of regional cooperation, and that, you know, the presentation from South African, from the NG department, it's all about what's our ownership, how are we going to be benefiting South Africa, are we going to be South African companies, and we mustn't forget to think about the great countries, Zimbabwe, but that, you know, almost a kind of article, that we still have a kind of individual, this idea of, when it comes to economic policy, the idea of cooperation, and those who have more must give more, or the idea of Ubuntu, I am because we are, it just doesn't center. And so there's a real contradiction of between sort of self-interest and interest, not only for that self-interest doesn't stretch towards a kind of broader social interest, but more kind of regime interest, individual interest, corporate interest. So I see that's been emerging, and so that's going to be quite critical. So when there is a treaty agreement, this idea of balance and equity. So just to end on my... If again with regionalism, if we're going to look at promoting regional integration, we'll have to question the nature of the SADC trade agreement, the investment agreement. And now South Africa did take a bold step with the bilateral investment treaties when Minister Rob Davies said that South Africa will not be renewing its bilateral investment treaties with Europe, because we see the consequences that, you know, we essentially not really benefiting, and when these corporations take us to the investment court, it's the cost of taxpayers' money. But the contradiction is we have to look at the bilateral investment treaties within the region, because we can't treat our neighbors the same way the major countries treat us. And so there has to be a re-look at this investment agreement so that it is more developmental. I'm going to end off with just to say, again, with free trade and trade liberalization. There's this, notion again that if we break down all the barriers to trade, and there's open trade, and we're in a situation where we must say, what are we trading? And we're still very much stuck in a natural resource economy, and we are limited around beneficiation. And so if we say, we're going to open up the trade, we're going to continue as a region, and even South Africa, our manufacturing is going down, that we're going to be continuing to trade primary goods. And so there has to be a re-look again at a different type of trade model. We can't just base this on, and this trade was very open about saying there has been you know, negative impacts of globalization, but it doesn't really say, then how are we going to address this, and how are you going to change the terms of trade and change the terms of investment and these international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF that, you know, continue policies that hurt the poor and social policies. Now, my last point is around civil society engagement. And so this paper speaks about the private sector and labor and government, and somehow leave out the people, but in a sense, sometimes labor or labor unions, and sometimes the workers aren't really involved in these discussions. But we really have to look at, and I know friends in Brazil, and their civil society networks are looking at organizing a foreign policy engagement with civil society. And our civil society may not be as organized, and but that must be part of government supporting the state. And where we can learn from the Europeans, that in the European Union, there comes a civil society running up and down, trying to lobby governments. We don't see the same static. It's very closed, and only if you the Southern African trade unions or the state council of NGOs, you have the space. And so the important thing is to create the space. And civil society is not, it's very messy, and as I said, it's not, you know, we don't have many that are directly involved in foreign policy, but many people, groups are involved in the various issues, whether it's energy or health, and they need to be engaged and in these discussions. And in a sense, these spaces have become very, it's limited. We don't have the kind of, you know, open spaces of discussing policy and interrogating as we used to do. So I'm going to end there, and then I just want to emphasize that, you know, Ubuntu means I am because we are. And a colleague from Brazil, Natal, is from Bukoman, and you know, it just maintains that that we have to work in a world and a region and around collaboration, cooperation, and begin to move away from this idea of a competitive environment. I'll end there.
Thank you very much, honourable members and ladies and gentlemen. It's 11:55. How much time do we want?